A grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The United States is like a big, powerful SUV cruising along, unaware that a well-engineered European sedan is coming up fast in the passing lane. That's the metaphor journalist T.R. Reid uses to describe the rising power of the European Union. He calls the EU a revolution, a geopolitical earthquake. T.R. Reid, author of The United States of Europe, The New Superpower, and The End of American Supremacy, is our guest this afternoon. At the outset of the book, he points out that 25 nations have joined together with another dozen or so on the waiting list to build a common economy, government, and culture. And he says Europe, while it can't match U.S. military strength, has more people, more wealth, and more trade than America. This afternoon, we'll talk about what this means for Europe and the U.S. Listeners, you're invited to join us, join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. T.R. Reid is a frequent commentator on NPR's Morning Edition. He is the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He has also served as the head of the paper's Tokyo and London bureaus. His new book, The United States of Europe, published by the Penguin Press. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. The numbers to call if you'd like to join the discussion. T.R. Reid, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Celeste. Delighted to be here.
Did you see on television the unveiling of the new gigantic Airbus jumbo jet?
I did, yes. Yeah, that's their big bet, that they have found a new approach to passenger jet travel.
Yeah, that was quite a ceremony. What were your thoughts about the spectacle?
Well, the Europeans are good marketers. I'm struck by Airbus, as you saw in my book. I write about Airbus because it was created by European governments and the EU specifically to be a European challenger to Boeing, and it worked. In 2003 and again in 2004, Airbus sold more passenger jets than Boeing did. Next, by 2006, people estimate that Airbus will have about 60% of the global passenger jet market. This is very bad for us, Celeste, because Boeing is our biggest exporter, and Boeing has always been number one in the world market for passenger jets. If we start to lose that market, we're in big trouble at a time when our country really needs to export to do something about our balance of trade deficit. So I deal with it in the book as an example of how the Europeans really are getting their act together and how this united Europe is a serious force in the global global atmosphere.
Yeah. I'm sure that we'll talk about the euro in more detail at some point this afternoon, but you know, I want to mention the fact that you write about the euro as not only a currency but also a political statement in this book. Is the Airbus jumbo jet also a political statement?
Yeah, I think it is. The reason that, as you said, 25 countries have come together and they've ceded a lot of the power that sovereign nations usually have to this federal government in Brussels. There are two reasons they did it, and one I think is quite noble. After World War II, a group of visionaries got together and said, you know, we've had brutal wars in Europe every 30 years, killed millions of people, and you could see in 1946 they were likely to do it again with the Iron Curtain coming down and everything. And these visionaries said, we have to find a new way to organize our ancient continent. It was Churchill who said, we need to build a sort of United States of Europe. which is, you know, that idea really caught on in Europe. It caught on with me. I made it the title of my book. And in that respect, it worked, because this new United States of Europe or European Union, they've gone 60 years now without a war between European countries. And you can go there and see there's not going to be a war. So I think that's pretty admirable. They found a way to organize their continent to avoid these brutal wars.
Yeah. That address by Churchill in 1946 in Zurich, is that the first time that a European leader spoke of the desirability of a common European citizenship?
No, this idea had been floating around. James Joyce used the term, let's build the United States of Europe, in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. That was 1916. The idea had been around, but, you know, those traditional national animosities were very strong, and national fervor was really at its peak, and it took the disaster of World War II and the Holocaust to kind of shock people into thinking we've got to do something different. At least that's the noble reason. Now, as I say in the book, I think there's another, perhaps less noble motivation, and that is, after World War II, if you're a German or French or British or Spanish, you can see those countries used to be the most important people, countries in the world, and you can now see that those countries are never going to be able to stand up individually to the political and financial power of the United States. But if you take Spain, Germany, Italy, France, Britain, Ireland, Sweden, Finland, Austria all together, yeah, as a group, they could. And I think creating what the European term for this is the counterweight theory, the creating the counterweight to American power, creating a second superpower in the world, is another key motivator. And that's where Airbus comes from. As part of the European Union, they decided they were going to build a single European champion in this huge global market for passenger jet planes. And guess what? They did it.
Yeah. Tony Blair told you the world needs a second superpower. Let's talk a little bit more about this idea of countervailing power thesis. When did that really begin to emerge and take hold? Right from the outset, do you think?
No, I think once when the Iron Curtain fell in 1990, and then the sort of overwhelming power of the United States, of course, we're still the biggest, strongest, most powerful nation in the world. And the Europeans, they couldn't match our military power. They don't want to. They don't want to spend money on military. And anyway, as I said, you know, a key reason they built their European Union was to get beyond war. But they felt they could. They felt there was room for a sort of a political and financial and a humanitarian force to stand either beside or sometimes against the United States. And the United States made some decisions that angered them. You know, our position on Kyoto, our position on the International Criminal Court, et cetera. All these, I'm arguing, kind of drove the Europeans to set themselves up as the un-America, the non-America in the world, to sort of propose a different social and international model. They're not into military or unilateralism. They're into cross-cultural, cross-border alliances, multilateral agreements is what they like. And that's the model they're pursuing, and they are holding it up as a counter to the American place in the world.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist T.R. Reid, our guest today. His latest book, The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our first listener this afternoon is calling from Muhammad on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I rather like, or I think it's a good idea to have the United States of Europe as a equipoise or counterweight to the United States. And yet, I wonder if you'd like to think about this, or how do you assess Europe's paralysis with regard to genocide in Europe, like is it in Bosnia? In that instance, the U.S., was it not the essential nation? And how have things changed, or have they changed?
I completely agree with you. In the Balkans, genocide and murder going on, and the Europeans talked about it. They just really didn't do anything about it. They wrung their hands, and it was only when the president of the U.S. said, you know, we're really not going to put up with this anymore, that something was done about it. I think the Europeans are kind of, they're ashamed of it, you know, that they did nothing. And I think in another situation, well, you could say Iraq is another such situation, the Europeans really didn't want to have anything to do with it. That's because in their view of the world, the police role, the military role, that's for us. They don't want to have anything to do with it. They're as little to do with it as they can get away with. And you know what? That plan is working for them because, fortunately for them, they have a sugar daddy in the world. We pay 70% of the cost of NATO. We have 100,000 American troops stationed in Europe to defend them. Against what? You know, but I don't blame them. If somebody were willing to pay our Defense Department bills for us and let us get away scot-free, I think we'd take that deal, too.
That, of course, the price they pay for that is the fact that we are preeminent, and therefore we do make military decisions, which the consequences of which the Europeans have to live with, right? So can they really rise without creating them for themselves a military ability to respond like all over the world or not?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that's the bet they've made. They're betting that you can be a superpower in the world in the 21st century without military power. Part of the bet is, as strong as we are and as weak as they may be, we're not going to attack France. You know, we may be mad at Germany, but we're not going to invade that country. And I think they're right. That's not going to happen.
No.
So, for the time being, their bet is paying off. And you're right. In military terms, if the United States wants to do something, well, we've demonstrated we don't care what Europe thinks. We don't care what the United Nations thinks. And all they can do is stand by. That's the price they're paying for the set of decisions they've made.
It's interesting to talk to you. I'll ring off. But I wonder if I just made one point that the United States didn't do anything in Bosnia either for like 4 years.
Yeah, we sat around, too. I completely agree with that.
Thank you.
How long do you think it will be? How long will this bet be a safe bet for the Europeans on defense?
It's a good question. They're committed to it. I'll tell you, I have a good friend, John Hume, who's a member of the European Parliament, an Irishman, won the Nobel Peace Prize, as a matter of fact, wonderful guy. And John is one of these Europeans who's always saying, yeah, we're building a superpower here. We're going to stand up to the USA. And I said to him once, he's the kind of guy you can talk to, you know. I said, come on, John. I mean, in military terms, Europe is a pipsqueak. There's not an army in Europe that could stand up to the Illinois National Guard, you know. And here's what John said, and I think this is a very common mindset in Europe today. He said, you know, if being the biggest military power in the world means you get to send 150,000 soldiers to Iraq and keep them there for 10 years, you can have it. We don't want it. And I think that's their view.
Hmm. T.R. Reid, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Do you see a new kind of European pride or, dare I use the word, patriotism emerging?
Yeah, I think there definitely is a sense of European pride. I think they're very proud of Airbus, for example. They take enormous pride in what we would call the welfare state, what they also call it the welfare state, or they call it the European social model. And when you go to these meetings of Europeans looking at the 21st century, they all point out with great pride that the notion that government should be there to protect people, to treat people when they're sick, and to take care of them when they get in financial trouble, they think that's a very strong European notion. The Americans, they think, have dropped the ball on this. And that's why they refer to it as a model. They're very proud that they can kind of export this notion to the rest of the world. I'll tell you one place where, somewhat to my surprise, I decided it worked, and that's healthcare. I took a family of five Americans to Europe. I work for the Washington Post. We have great health insurance. And yet we use the free National Health Service provided by the government because it worked great for us. The doctor comes to your house. You never get a bill. You never have that three-month fight with the insurance company over who's going to pay because there's no bill to pay. And, you know, for the kind of illnesses that an average family has, measles, mumps, broken bones, rashes, flu, The treatment was fantastic. It was just as good as in America. I don't think it was any better, but it was just as good, and it was free.
I was surprised that it was free for you.
Well, I paid the taxes. I mean, when we first got there, we lived in London and we're paying 17.5% sales tax.
Okay.
That's double what I pay in Colorado. You know, by European standards, that's kind of cheap. In Denmark, it's 25%. In Ireland, it's 21%. So I paid for it. But, you know, I tried to figure it out. It's a little hard because you get a lot more than just health care for your tax dollar. But I think I came out about the same as I did when I was paying the $400 a month for medical insurance in America. And the treatment was good. And they come to your house.
Yeah. Well, I was just surprised in the opening to that chapter where you're just newly arrived there and your daughter has an ear infection and you've got to get her to the doctor. And it's like, okay, that's it. Thank you very much. And you're on your way. And no, you don't, no bill.
No, I pulled out my checkbook. They gave her great treatment. We had to go to the emergency ward because we didn't have a doctor yet. They gave her great treatment. We waited a few minutes and they were very kind and decent. And boy, I was willing to pay. You know, a parent who sees his daughter cured, of course I was willing to pay. Mm. And the nurse said to me with great pride, you know, she said, oh, no, you Americans, you always pull out your checkbooks, but you don't need to. We're not going to charge you for treating your illness. That's not what the way things work here. She was really proud of it. And as we were leaving the hospital, my wife said, well, see, that's why we pay the 17.5%. Mm. You of course you pay for it. But it's a pretty good system. In fact, if you want to compare medical systems, as I do in the book, the Europeans have longer life expectancy than we do. They have just about the same quality of care. They have the same recovery rate from every major disease. They cover every single person. Every human being on the continent is covered by health insurance. And they do it all for half the cost per capita that we spend. To me, you get the same treatment, covers more people, and you spend less. That's a better system, isn't it?
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Oh, thank you. Actually, you kind of made the point I was about to make, is that if you compare outcomes over the population, they have a better health system because all those things you said were true. I mean, they, you know, by objective standards, if you're comparing the health of the public, they're better off and at less cost. And I would also go back to the point you were, you know, saying earlier about the cost of sustaining the military. I think that at some point that is going to be what drags us down as a nation and make us far less competitive in the world. And I just think it's a fool's bargain on our part, because I think that in the 21st century, we're going to find out that war is not a sustainable option as a way of maintaining of foreign policy. And I know from, you know, having read some of the things that the neocons have said, that they really do believe that they can use our military to sustain our economic dominance in the world. And I think it's just wrong, and it's going to, you know, in the next 20 to 30 years, it's going to become obvious that you know, that was the wrong track, and we're going to end up being, you know, quite a few notches down in the world.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. That you, I think you've put your finger right on the terms of the disagreement. The Europeans are kind of going your way. They're betting that they're going to be a political and a humanitarian and a financial power and not worry about military power. And the United States still is committed to being the policeman and to maintaining military power, even at enormous cost.
But I think, you know, the purpose of that military power is not so much to be a policeman as, you know, I mean, we have all this beautiful rhetoric about freedom and all that, but what it's really about is maintaining our economic dominance in the world. And instead, it's going to, you know, lead us to the way of Rome and so many other empires that, you know, eventually will collapse under the weight of the cost of it. Plus, I mean, we'll just keep annoying people to the extent that, you know, I mean, we've already pretty much lost much of our political capital in the world since, you know, I mean, we had this beautiful moment after 9/11 where the whole world was basically sympathetic and you know, willing to cooperate with us, and we've just, you know, pissed that away.
Yeah, I talk about that in the book. I think that we definitely, our esteem and affection for our country really has decayed badly around the world in recent years. But I think a lot of that, frankly, let's be blunt about it, is anti-Bushism more than it's anti-Americanism. People don't like the policies, and particularly the war policies, of the Bush administration. I think the Europeans were surprised and disturbed by our choice to reelect President Bush. But here's what I think. I think it's going to get better because President Bush is going to the EU. He's going to visit Brussels next month. He's then going to go to Berlin and meet Chancellor Schroeder of West Germany, a man he hasn't spoken to in 2 years. I think, and I think a lot of this is being pushed by his friend Tony Blair, I think President Bush is going to try to mend those fences. And the Europeans know they've got to get along with America, so they want to see the fences mended. I think the situation's going to be better in the second term.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Let me reintroduce our guest. T.R. Reid is our guest. He's a journalist. He's with the Washington Post. His latest book is The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. T.R. Reid is the author of 3 books in Japanese and 5 in English, including Confucius Lives Next Door and The Chip, How 2 Americans Invented the Microchip and Launched a Revolution. He's a frequent commentator on NPR's Morning Edition. He is now the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. He's also served as the head of the paper's Tokyo and London bureaus. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Join the discussion. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hi. What is the furor in Europe over the decline in value of the dollar? And would this also be occurring in the Asian countries?
It's somewhat mixed in Europe for this reason. the Europeans threw away their marks and liras and francs and pesetas 3 years ago and adopted this common currency. 12 nations now use it. It's going to grow to about 20 nations. And at the time, I have a lot of fun with this in my book. All the American experts said, oh, God, this will never work. I quote all these people in my book as saying, don't you dare invest a penny in the euro. If you had invested in the euro on the first day of its life, January 1st of 2002, you would have made 60% on your investment. It's been the fastest growing, strongest currency in the world. And the Europeans are proud of that. I mean, because, as I say, they're trying to create a counterweight to American power in the world. And one of the major reasons for the dollar's decline, one of the reasons, is that there's now an alternative where people who always used to buy U.S. Treasury bonds now feel there's another safe reserve currency in the world where they can put their money in, so they're putting it into euros instead. The Europeans think that's great. That's a great European achievement. On the other hand, it also makes it, the weak dollar makes it very hard for Americans to buy European products or to take vacations in Europe. I don't know if you've been to France recently, but everything, Italy, Britain, it's outrageously expensive. And that's hurting their economy, so they're kind of mixed on it. I think the Asian countries are just very unhappy. It's harder for them to export to America with the weak dollar, and they don't have the kind of saving grace that their currency is the one that's emerging as the alternative. The Europeans, at least, have, I think it's quite palpable. In fact, they brag about it out loud. They're proud that their euro is the seems to be the currency at the moment that's trouncing the almighty dollar.
What is the chance that people shun the U.S. bonds?
You know, it's starting to happen. 2 weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal, they had a story about a poll of 65 central bankers. The central bank is the big government bank that holds the money in every country, Bank of China, Bank of Japan, Bank of England, example. And of those 65, two-thirds of them said they weren't going to invest any more money in U.S. Treasury bonds or U.S. dollars. They were going to put their money into the euro instead. this is really bad for us because we need those people buying. When they buy a treasury bond, basically they're lending us money. We have to agree to pay it back in 20 years. We need those loans from central banks around the world to make up for our budget deficit. And if the euro now emerges as an alternative place they can put the money, we're going to have to pay higher interest rates to get those people to lend us the monies we need to make up for our deficit. I see this as a really serious problem for the United States.
How much higher?
How much higher are our interest rates going to go?
I'm
not the guy to estimate that. Double, triple over the next 5 years. They're not very high right now. The problem with that is then that raises mortgage rates, then that kind of puts a damper on the housing boom, which has been the key to our economic growth in the last 2 years. The whole thing starts to catch up with itself. Now, the alternative theory is, oh, no, the dollar is so strong and the U.S. is so powerful that people will never really move away from investing in the dollar. Let's hope that's true. The problem is now that the euro is there as a reliable and valuable currency, there's an alternative to the dollar for people who are worried about our deficit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. As you point out in the book, it makes you kind of want to head down to the neighborhood tap for a 7-7, but...
Both 7-Up and Seagram 7 are owned by European companies. Yeah, you can't. You're not going to get away that way.
Yeah. I was amazed. There's a list. There's quite a list in the book of brands that are actually European products. And not only that, but in the grocery store these days, we're seeing more and more products that are proudly labeled from Europe. You know, like butter is showing, European butter is showing
yeah,
up in the supermarket.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it doesn't even have to be European. I mean, I can't believe it's not butter is owned by a British company. You know, you drive your Jeep down to the Amoco station, the American oil company. Well, you're driving a German product down to a gas station owned by the Brits. This level of British, of European investment in our country is massive. And I don't think most Americans know it. That's why I talk about it in the book a lot. I mean, you know, nothing more American than apple pie, but Mott's apple pie filling is owned by a Swiss company. The U.S. shoe company is owned by Italians. So, and this is a good thing. I mean, in many ways, it's a good thing. It's great. If they want to invest their money in our economy rather than their own, that's fine. Creates jobs, you know, creates businesses here. The downside of it is that it gives them, it gives Europeans some economic control over the working life of Americans. For example, I describe in the book, you know, in most European countries, part of this welfare state, it's illegal to downsize. It's hard for them to fire anybody. And Diageo, this big British kind of food and drinks company, got in some trouble on the London Stock Exchange. They had to cut costs. They're really not allowed to fire anybody in their European operation. So you know what they did? They laid off 8,000 Americans working at Burger King. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing that they're buying our product, buying our companies, but it puts us at the mercy of European boards of directors.
Yeah, and those poor folks at Burger King, they couldn't go out and have a Captain Morgan's rum now, could they?
Well, that's not another... if they wanted to buy American,
yeah,
they couldn't.
Absolutely. That's the same company.
I mean, even Snapple, you know.
Yeah.
So Texaco, the Texas oil company, now belongs to the Dutch.
Armour corned beef hash.
Doesn't Quaker State Motor Oil sound American to you? That's owned by Royal Dutch Shell.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, we have this interesting love-hate relationship, Europeans and Americans, Americans and Europeans. How do the Europeans see us first on that hate side of the equation? And then maybe you'd talk with us a little bit about the love side of the equation.
Yeah, I think the Europeans see and appreciate a lot of the big virtues of our country. I think they really recognize how innovative we are. I think they're, you know, they know how open we are to new ideas and new people. Well, I mean, you know, just about everybody in Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe, has a cousin or a neighbor or a grandson who emigrated to Champaign-Urbana, you know, and is now American. So I think they see the openness of America, the freedom of America. But boy, they really love America bashing. That's a great national pastime in Europe. They portray us as insular. They think we don't know anything about the rest of the world. They really hate at sports events. They just despise when the American fans get together and chant USA, USA. I mean, it's really interesting to see how that it just drives Europeans up the wall. They complain about it on TV. There are a lot of aspects of our country that they love to make fun of. I don't think they're right about most of them. I don't think we're insular at all. I think, I wrote a book about the European Union. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. How insular can we be?
Yeah. Well, tell us about the Lardbergers, though.
Yeah. Jeff and Stacey Lardberger, they're two totally typical Americans who show up on a British morning show called The Big Breakfast. It's kind of a funny show. I used to watch it because it was funny, and then Jeff and Stacey came along. These are two typical Americans. They're both about as fat as the Michelin Man. They live in a trailer in Texas. They're constantly fighting. The only thing they really agree on is that they have to get together now and then to go down to the welfare office and get their check. They, of course, both believe in the death penalty, and they have a framed picture of George W. Bush on the wall. Just your typical Americans. And the Lardbergers fit a lot of European stereotypes about Americans. Crude, overweight people, we wear Bermuda shorts with black socks. We think Rome is in Georgia. We think Notre Dame should be pronounced Notre Dame, like that. So, The Lardbergers make fun of all those stereotypes.
Yeah, and the Lardbergers are riding around in an SUV. Meantime, that svelte sedan is coming up awfully quickly. And here we get to the metaphor that you open the book with, and we tie it in with the Lardbergers.
Yeah.
How is it that the U.S. has been so slow to see this sports car coming?
Boy, that's a good question. I'm reluctant to answer because it suggests maybe we are as insular as the Europeans say we are. I think I say in the book, Americans had this notion that Europeans are rich socialists, with free universities and free medical care, and they take 6 weeks of vacation a year. Their productivity is lower than ours. That's definitely true. If you have 5 weeks off a year, you're not going to be as productive, as a country that gets 3 weeks off a year. But I think that this notion that they're a bunch of lazy socialists is a myth, and it's a dangerous myth for Americans. Motorola is a great American high-tech company, and right at the time when the global cell phone market was taking off, boom, all of a sudden Motorola was passed by two European companies. Today, the American champion Motorola is number three in the world in cell phone sales, and Nokia, Finnish company, has twice the market share that Motorola does. So I think Americans were, people like their stereotypes, just like the Europeans like their picture of us, even wrong as it is. I think Americans were happy with the notion that Europeans were lazy and socialist and we didn't have to worry about them. And now I think particularly the business world is really catching on to the fact that Europe counts.
Yeah. Let's talk with another couple of listeners. First, we're going to go to Champaign County, listener on line one. You're on the line this afternoon with T.R. Reid. Go ahead.
Hi. I haven't been able to listen to all, but you just were sort of saying that Americans aren't insular, but can you name the one almost industrialized country that has less passports held per person than the U.S.?
Well, yeah, you might be right about that, but I mean,
Well, it's North Korea, the Hermit Kingdom.
Well, yeah. Well, that's because they don't allow anybody. But I don't know. Americans travel. I mean, every place you go in the world, you see American travelers. If you live in Europe and, the next country is 20 miles away, well, you need a passport just to go to the store or something. And I don't know that conveys that much. I'll tell you the argument I used to make. Look, well, there are two arguments. The first is, hey, if we're so insular and ignorant, how come we're the richest, most powerful country in the history of the world? The Europeans never liked that argument, as you can imagine.
Well, there are 16 countries that have higher standard of living.
That's true. Yeah.
So being the richest is is good for, you know, the people that are the richest, but it isn't spread well, and it doesn't, the quality of life, you know, you can make lots of arguments. So.
Yeah, I agree with that. I certainly think, I don't think there's ever been, I used to say this in Europe, there's never been a bigger collection of races and creeds and languages and cultures than the United States of America. I said in Britain, you know, there are 125,000 American citizens whose first language in the home is Cambodian. I don't think there are 125 people in all of Europe who can speak Cambodian, but this never got me any points in Europe. They would say, well, you imported those people. That doesn't count, right? But that's part of what the genius of America is, that we have taken these people from all over the world, and that's why we're aware of what's going on elsewhere.
Yeah, but then the argument is that how many people have second and third languages? That's an insularity in effect, too. And here we have English first and all of that stuff. So, you know, wish I could go visit again, actually, but haven't in a while. Thanks.
Yeah, okay. Good luck.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with another listener now, a caller in Champaign online, too. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Maybe this is kind of timely to say after the last caller. I teach German here in Champaign.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I have kids who are 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. And really, for their benefit, I'm asking this question because I'm going to have them listen to your show tomorrow.
Okay.
Given that they learn German pretty well, and
yep,
they get pretty good, they do some at college. In 10 years, they're 25, 26, 27. What opportunities are going to be available for them as Americans who are dealing with the European Union? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Sure. Germany is clearly the powerhouse of the European Union, and I think the EU as a whole, as I say in my book, is coming along as a superpower to equal America. It has more people, it has more money, it has more trade. They give away more foreign aid to more countries than we do. And so if you have a grasp of German for the first place, you can go to a lot of Europe and conduct business because the Scandinavians all use Germanic languages. I used to be able to read the newspaper in Holland. It's a different language, but it's a Germanic language. It's close enough. If your German is good, you'll be able to read the newspapers there too. So I think it really opens a huge amount of Central Europe, Mitteleuropa, to you. So it's valuable to know. And the other great thing is, and I think this is very important, is that in learning a foreign language, you learn that culture. You get close to that culture in a way that you could never do if you didn't speak the language. So it's given you a big leg up to the country that is the most important. It's the pivotal country of this new federal union that's challenging the United States in global power.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener on line 3, also in Champaign. Hi. Caller there?
Hi.
Go ahead. No? Okay. No. Let's move on to another listener. Caller in Urbana on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hello. I'm just calling to see if you could give me your opinion about the levels of society in Europe. I've lived there twice, and my experience is that, sure, there's an educated elite that's not insular and that knows a lot about the world, but if you just take your average grocery store clerk, they go on vacation. Maybe they live in Belgium, and they go on vacation in France, and they haven't particularly been anywhere. They seem to be fairly racist about different immigrant groups in Europe. And I don't think that they are any less insular than your average American. Could you just comment on that and I'll hang up?
Okay.
I basically agree with that. In the first place, I don't think of Americans as insular, and I have argued strenuously against that stereotype. But there certainly are Europeans who still have kind of cherished the old xenophobias. I think you remember when we were unable to get the second resolution for the UN on Iraq, and the Brits and the Bush administration both blamed the French. You know, that's not really fair. The French were against the war in Iraq, but so were most other countries in the world. But they went after the French because it's very easy to get either British people or Americans angry at France for some reason. So, yeah, I think that same kind of xenophobia does exist in Europe, but the point of the European Union is to get beyond it, and I think they're doing that for one reason, because of the fear of another world war was so great, and the other motivator, as I said, being it's only through working together, France and Germany, the traditional rivals, and Britain and Italy and Holland and Estonia and Hungary, it's only through working together that that EU can stand up as the counterweight to American power that they want to be. And I think those motivators are overcoming the traditional sort of nationalistic animosities that existed in Europe for millennia.
Let's take another call. Line two, caller in Champaign. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Reed, I'm enjoying your comments very much, but I just wanted to correct something that a previous caller said. He said that we ranked about 16th in the world in standard of living.
Yeah.
If you use purchasing power parity, you know, PPP, that's really not true. We really rank number one, and there's really nobody even close to us.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with that. The U.S. is obviously a very rich, powerful country. I don't think there's any need to play that down.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that what affects a lot of these studies that, you know, we read about in the paper, they're not really even studies, but I think they take the lazy way out, and they look at total income in, say, Germany, and they just use the current exchange rate to convert it back into dollars. But if the euro was going up against the dollar at the time, then we don't look so good. But if you take purchasing power parity as a method where you take out the fluctuating currency, and as such it's a more accurate way of measuring standard of living, and I'm not thumping my chest for America right now, but, I mean, the hard evidence actually shows that we're at least 15 to 20% ahead of whoever's in second, which I think is Norway or Sweden.
Yeah, those countries are very wealthy. Luxembourg is another, Austria, very wealthy countries, too. But, yeah, I mean, the U.S. is clearly the rich, powerful force, leading force in the world. One of the points of the European Union, and that's what I wrote my book about to tell Americans this, is that they want to be the second superpower. They want to stand up to us, and frankly, they've got the population and the money and the trade and political clout in the world to do it. In fact, they're doing it.
Right.
So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for the
thank
call you. This afternoon. We only have a couple minutes left here in this portion of the program today, and thinking back to our language teacher and her students studying German, maybe you would talk a little bit about Generation E.
Yeah, Generation E is the younger cohort of Europeans, age 15 to 40, and these are people who are living the unification of Europe. They may be living in Tallinn or Toledo, but more than Estonian, more than Spanish, they're European. These young people, anybody, has the right under EU law to live, work, study, or vote in any of the 25 countries, and they take advantage of it. And I say in the book, they're building a common European culture. David Beckham, a soccer player for Real Madrid, is bigger than Michael Jordan ever was in the United States. And I even say they're developing a common European language. The French don't like it much, but the fact is it's German. When a stock trader from Helsinki gets together in a club in Paris with a lawyer from London and a teacher from Sweden, they speak English. That's their language. And so Generation E really is kind of the core of this common European culture that is emerging, which I talk about at great length in my book. They all listen to the same songs on MTV Europe. You know, they watch the same TV shows because they show all over the EU. And so Generation E really is this, it feels like being in America. It feels like sitting in a bar in Champaign and the guy next to you is from New Hampshire. That kind of feeling is now happening in Europe, too.
Yeah. And we're all going to get around the tube in a week or so and watch the Super Bowl, but in Europe, the thing is Eurovision. You want to
Eurovision.
Just tell us a little.
Kish kind of
so is the Super
song,
Bowl.
Popular song contest, and each country gets to enter one band. It's usually some third-rate lounge act, although I have to say that ABBA got its start on Eurovision. And then it kind of has a feel like the Miss America contest, but the difference is at the end of the show, tens of millions of people from all over Europe are allowed to call in and vote for the winner. It's not just a panel of judges. And on the last Saturday in May, hundreds of millions of people all over Europe watched this kind of schlocky song contest. And, you know, some people really love it, and some people just love the fact that it's so awful. But anyway, it's incredibly successful, and as I argue in the book, is another force kind of uniting Europe into one place.
Hmm. Sounds a little bit like our Super Bowl halftime show.
Yeah, like the Super Bowl halftime show, except if somebody showed a bare breast on Eurovision, nobody would blink an eye.
Right.
They don't get upset about that.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. T.R.
Okay.
Reid, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Celeste. It was great. Thanks a lot.
T.R. Reid, his latest book, The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. The book is published by The Penguin Press, which, by the way, is owned by a British company, Pearson. So there you have it, Penguin Press. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here is Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Hey, speaking of unifying powers across the world, Chicago Board of Trade, one of those things probably that Europe looks at pretty often as well, as they set most of the grain prices across the globe. Let's start there and take a look at what happened in Chicago today that will have an impact in Brazil and Argentina and Europe and China and the Ukraine. Here we go with the wheat pit, the March contract, a 292 high, low at 287.5, a settlement price there, $2.91 a bushel for the nearby March contract in the wheat pit. They were up a penny for the day. May futures a 299 high, low at 295, settled at 298.75, up 1.25. And July futures 306.25, the high, the low at 303. A settlement price at 305.5. They were up 0.75 for the day. September futures 311.5, the high, the low at 309. Settled 311, up 0.75. And December futures now up a penny and a quarter. 321, the high, the low at 318. Settlement price $3.20 for the December contract in the wheat pit. From the corn pit, they finished the day a penny and a quarter higher in the nearby contract, that being the March. 197.5, the high, the low at 195.25. The final price for the day, $1.97 even, up 1.25 for the March corn. May futures, 205, the high, the low at 202.75. The May contract settled, 204.5, up 1.25. And the July, 212.25, the high, low at 210.25, settled 211.75. They were up 1 for the day. September futures, 220, the high, the low at 217.75. September, generally speaking, your last old crop month for the year, 219.25, up 0.75. Now the new crop, December contract, 229.5, the high for the corn, the low at $2.27.25, settled at $2.28.75, up 1 for the day. March futures for next year, 237, the high, the low at 234.5, that March 2006 corn contract at 236.25 settlement price. And they finished up 1 for the day. March oats 171.75, the high, the low at 167. $1.67.25 was the settlement price for the March contract. They were down 2.5 in the May off, rather up a penny and a quarter. 161 the high, the low at 59.75, a settlement price there at 60.5. That's $1.60.5 up 1.25 for the May oats. March beans now, 518.5 the high, the low at $5.10, settled at 514.75, up 0.75 for the day. May futures at 515.5 high, low at 508, settled 512.5. They were off a half, and July off a half as well. 520.25 the high, the low at 13, and settlement price at $5.17.5. Once again, that July contract off a half for the soybeans. August futures, 522 the high, the low at 516, settled 520, down a penny and a quarter. And the September beans, 525 the high, the low at 520.5, settlement price at $5.22. They were down a half. And the November, your new crop soybeans, 533 the high, the low at 527.5, and the price 531. For a bushel of beans next November, down a half cent. January futures at 538, the high, the low at 534.5. A settlement price there at $5.37 for the January 2006 contract, and they were down a half for the day. March bean meal, 155.80, the high, the low at 153.30. A settlement price at 153.80. They were off 30 cents. And the May bean meal, 155, the high, the low at 152.70. Settlement price at 153, down 80. March bean oil, 1953, the high, the low at 1915, settled 1936, up 12 cents. And the May bean oil, $19.65, the high, the low at 1927, and a settlement price at $19.50. They were up 11 for the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. Mostly higher day today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, $100.80 the high, $99.45 the low, $100.52.5 the settlement, that up 30. April, $100.30 the high, $99.20 the low, $100.27.5 the settlement, that up 22.5. May, $99.60 the high, $98.60 the low, $99.55 the settlement, that up 15. February live cattle, $90.35 the high, $89.15 the low, $90.22.5 the settlement, that up 45. April, $88.40 the high, $87.25 the low, the settlement, $88.32.5, that up 65. February lean hog, $74.30 the high, $73.45 the low, the settlement, $73.77.5, that down 35. April, $75.80 the high, $74.95 the low, the settlement, $75.55, that up 25. May, $76.30 the high, $75.60 the low, $76.22.5 the settlement, that up 15. June lean hog, $78.47.5 the high, $77.70 the low, $78.35 the settlement, that up 20. February pork bellies, $94.70 the high, $93.30 the low, $94.00 even the settlement, that down 37.5. The Dow up 59 points at 10,486. The NASDAQ 26 higher at 2062. The S&P 500 up 9 points at 1181.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming on AM 580 as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
H. Winfield Schaefer from Shelton, Washington writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do computers count in the binary system?"
They only have two fingers. We, who were born with 10, naturally invented a decimal counting system. The first computer was invented in 1664 by Sri Rav Gopal, a mathematician in Calcutta, India, who devised a wooden and india rubber computer based on the number of fingers in the Hindu god Honeywell. I think it was 64,280. Not much work got done with that computer, but it was beautiful to look at. The English confiscated it sometime in the 19th century and turned it into a loom, which they exported to Northern Ireland, used to make shirts and enslave the local populace.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online about the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary live show on DVD, go to drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater.